changes color with the changing skies, and lovely beyond belief, the dazzling surf on the outer reef murmurs its timeless lullaby.
The plot of Noel Coward's Brief Encounter is a familiar one. A chance meeting leads to a short but doomed romance. But in the new theater piece inspired by the 1945 film, this classic story is given a whole new twist to the delight of audiences both here and in Britain. Brief Encounter is currently in Brooklyn at St. Anne's Warehouse through January 17th, and joining me now are the director, Emma Rice, who also wrote the adaptation, and Annette McLaughlin, who plays Myrtle. I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show today. Hello.
Thank you. Hello.
We were just listening to a song by Noel Coward. There are songs by him that are interspersed throughout the production, songs that I didn't recognize, and I thought I knew most of the Noel Coward songs.
Ah, well, the song you've just heard, The Wide Lagoon, actually isn't a Noel Coward song. It's Noel Coward poem called The Wide Lagoon, which we've set to contemporary music, so that's probably why you don't recognize it.
But there are some other songs. He wrote a lot of songs.
Yeah, we've got Mad About the Boy, which is probably one of his most famous, Any Little Fish, and A Room with a View, which is a beautiful song.
Didn't he first write this as a play called Still Life?
That's correct. It was a one-act play. But it was a selection of one-act plays. There were five in the group that he wrote for himself and Gertrude Lawrence. So it was just a tiny one-act play, yeah, called Still Life, which they then expanded into the film version.
And did he write it for David Lean? David Lean directed it?
David Lean directed, and Noel Coward wrote the screenplay.
And they retitled it Brief Encounter.
Correct.
Which is a more memorable title than Still Life, even though Still Life does make some sense.
Yeah, it's a sort of, it's quite a down title, isn't it? I feel Still Life. The word still is not something you want to think about when you go to the theatre.
The question one might ask is, do you think that the two lovers, Alec and Laura, are unhappy with their lives when they meet? Or are they just, is there just such a powerful chemistry that it doesn't matter?
Well, it'd be interesting to know what Annette thinks, but I think the clue is in the word still. I don't think they know they're unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
I think possibly Alec is more unhappy than Laura. I certainly don't think she knows she's unhappy, but her life sort of isn't moving and isn't passionate and isn't alive.
Now, Annette, you play a lot of characters, but mostly the cafe owner
station.
At a train station.
That's right, yeah.
And you witness them. Since Emma suggested that we ask you, what do you think? Do you think that that these two lovers were unhappy before they found
each other? I think they're just
kind
of going through their everyday life, and this meeting takes them by surprise and makes them possibly realise that they're not as happy as they thought they were, and there is something else out there. And it's quite interesting with the more of the play with our characters, with Myrtle and Albert. We get to see more of their journey of love, and of Stanley and Beryl as well. So you have these three different love affairs going on, and some end happily like ours and some not so happily.
Well, much of it is done as something of a comedy, and only their love affair is not handled as a comedy. I'm assuming that was your plan from the start.
Well, I don't know. I'm immediately thinking, I think life's quite funny, full stop, really. I certainly didn't decide to make some characters funny and some characters not. I think,
but there's a lot of humour in this play.
There's an awful lot of humour, and that's I certainly, if there's ever humour to be found, then I'm going to liberate it, because, you know, we want to have a good time when we go out, don't we?
Well, was Noel Coward wrote some very witty lines throughout his career, but was there? I don't remember Brief Encounter, the film, being a laugh riot.
No, but then the film is played at a breakneck pace. You know, I think I've slowed things down and used a slightly more contemporary rhythm to the humour. But every word is Noel Coward's. You know, I mean, there's no gags put in there.
And the way, for my character, the way that she speaks in a sort of hoity-toityness is all written down on the page. He wrote it like that, didn't he?
Yeah, that's in dialect.
Is brilliant.
So this is the exact script that he wrote for the film?
No, what I've done is I've pieced together bits of his poetry, bits of his music, bits from Still Life and bits from the film. But there isn't a word that isn't Noel Coward.
Hmm. But what led you to think of this? This is just, the Knee High is famous as a theatre group that does that does rather daring things. Brief Encounter seems to me to be one of the least daring pieces of film writing.
Yeah, there's no manifesto to Knee-High Theatre. You know, we just tell stories and we try and tell the stories that we're passionate about at any time. I think I'm sort of consistently interested by love and our ability to fulfil it and indeed not fulfil that. So Brief Encounter for me is a story that I knew I wanted to tell and have certainly been in a very similar position myself. And I'm sure I'll be there again.
Well, you're British, so the love affair is very restrained.
Oh, yes. Always.
But that is part of what... I don't know whether it's restrained because of the times, because of the fact that they both would appear to have been happily married, or is it because of the culture they're coming out of? Now, this is right after World War II.
It's right before, actually. He wrote it in 1938. The film was made later. I mean, it's a really interesting question. Even in Britain, one of the things that the press have certainly discussed about the show is whether it's a period piece because they don't actually consummate this relationship. But I think people struggle with morality to this day. Now, maybe society accepts that we're all much more fallible than was accepted in the 1930s, but I think the struggle is the same. Most of us are trying to do our best and trying to live a good life. So I think the restraint is profound and universal.
Now, you decided to do this when you became the artistic director of Knee-High. What about you, Annette? Have you been connected to Knee-High for a while?
This is my first show with Knee-High, yeah.
What had you done earlier?
I've done lots of different things. Musicals and Shakespeare and dancing and straight plays. Lots, kind of like to keep trying different things.
And you sing very well. We hear you singing. In fact, I noticed your beautiful voice before the play ever began. You were one of the singing
That's right,
ushers.
In our pre-show, yeah. Yeah, we chat to the audience and sing some songs. And
isn't Knee-High based in Cornwall?
Yes.
Does that allow for people taking more chances than if it were based in London, do you think?
Shall I answer that?
Because of commercial pressure?
Yeah, no, I think it's... I mean, we choose to work in Cornwall, and many of us have chosen to live outside of the capital, and I think it means that we're truly independent. We don't tend to look around and see what other people are doing, and we certainly don't try and make work that's going to be commercially successful. We make the work we want to make. We have a great time doing it, and I make work with my friends. You know, it's a fantastic ensemble of people, which you can feel on stage. You feel the joy coming off the stage. So I do think it makes us more independent and braver.
But when I think of theatrical groups throughout England, they're usually in the north, and Cornwall is in the south.
Yeah, there's plenty of arts going on in the south. But, you know, we often think we're right down in the foot. We sort of feel like outsiders, and that suits us, really. But we look out to sea. We always think we don't look into London. We look out through the foot of
the most magical place. Where there's barns, Knee-High have barns where they work and live and eat together and work on a piece, and it's on the side of a cliff, and it's absolutely beautiful and magical and wonderful place.
There's an awful lot of inventive stagecraft throughout the production, like walking through a screen at the beginning of the play when a train goes through the station. You're using experimental theatrical devices to tell a rather traditional story. Does Knee-High use a similar approach to everything that it does?
No, there's no formula, and never should there be. The work's always guided by the story and how one responds to that. So, of course, the first thing you get with Brief Encounter is it's an incredibly well-known and well-loved film. And then the second thing is I'm going to return it to the stage. So that was really my starting point, is I wanted it to be incredibly theatrical and a sort of gorgeous night out, but also to really honour the fact that it's an iconic film, which is where the idea of the screen came from.
And you must have been worried about messing with such a beloved movie.
I never worry about things like that. It's my mission in life to mess with all sorts of things.
Is what we're seeing in St. Anne's Warehouse pretty much what we would have seen when it opened in Cornwall?
Yes, it was completely recognisable. It's continued to evolve. There's a few songs I've tried, Noel Coward songs, which didn't really fit. So some of the musicality has changed. And the big thing that's changed is we used to have an intermission, which we don't have anymore. And I think that's been a really brave and exciting step, because it feels more like a film and it's an irresistible momentum.
And when you did it in London, didn't you do it in a converted movie theatre?
We did, yes.
So that must have even pushed that sense even further.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think we're doing it at St. Anne's Warehouse as well, as I always try and slightly subvert the expectation of going to the theatre. So I always try and start the event before we start. So when you go to St. Anne's Warehouse, as you say, the guys are all out there playing musical instruments, warming the space up. There's popcorn to eat. And that was great in London when we did have the converted cinema, as there's very much a sense that this wasn't your ordinary theatre event where you'd go and get your gin and tonic and sit neatly in your seat.
And after the production, many people stay and have and eat with the cast and drink with the cast. And you've been
sandwiches.
Doing that. So does that mean that this is probably a longer night than anything you've done other than Eugene O'Neill, because you start...
I tell you what, though, it doesn't feel like it. The show, once you get going with the show, it just zips by.
And but you start beforehand.
We start singing before. Which is lovely as well. You know, you get to chat to people and to find out where people have come from and whether they've seen the show before, whether they've seen the film, and you get to have a bit of a sing. And then you kind of get to know your audience personally, which is quite fun. And then afterwards, you get to chat to people as well, and they get to listen to a bit more music and have a cucumber sandwich or two. So it's good fun.
We try and, the whole company, we try and blur the lines. Yeah, I can't bear it when, you know, actors go in through a different door and then they vanish into the night, and it's this sort of, and there's the fourth wall. It's like something mysterious has happened. The magic happens between the audience and the performers, and there's nothing mysterious. They can talk to us, they can have a drink with us. And I think it's wonderful. There's such a sense of humanity. And like you say, it's brilliant for the actors and for us as well, is that you really feel that I call it the temporary communion.
Now, there are a number of couplings, or whatever words we want to use, in amongst the people involved in the story. There's a real strong sense of class. Was that something that Noel Coward was commenting on?
Yes. He's criticised a little bit because there's a sense that the middle-class couple and their restraint, you know, sort of don't have sex. Meanwhile, all the other cafe characters do. But that's not true.
Slightly lower class.
Yeah.
You have to change your accent a bit, don't you?
I do, yeah. She's great fun to play, though, because she thinks she's so much more hoity-toity than she is, which is great fun.
I mean, I think that, you know, there's still class within England, but I think certainly at the time there were different rules. But, you know, as I say, everybody's dealing with different stages of their life. It's not the same to have first young love as it is to be having an illicit forbidden passion.
Didn't you consider for a little while setting this during wartime and then decide to keep it where Coward had it before the war?
I did. I mean, it's interesting because we think of it, the film itself is very iconic in its wartime imagery. There's blackouts. But in fact, the war is never... 1945, they made the film. But there's no reference within the text to the war at all, which, as I began working on the piece, began to bother me, because really you want to know why the husband isn't at war or why they're not. And the words themselves are very much rooted before the war. But I also thought this was rather exciting, that the calamity that is to come, that certainly with hindsight, we know what happened. And I find it, the pathos, you say that they're comedy characters, but actually the young boy who's very silly and very full of life, and we know that he's probably going to be dead in 3 years' time. We know that young couple have very little to look forward to.
Well, we have seen any number of pieces about brief encounters during wartime. People meet and then he goes off to war or she goes off to war. This is probably, with the sense of war about to occur, this may even be more effective. Do you think that the fact that Noel Coward was gay gave him a window into the feelings of his protagonists, Alec and Laura, because they can't express their feelings in the open?
Definitely. I think what it must have been like for him and for members of the gay community in the 1930s, I can only imagine how painful and frustrating and agonising that must have been. And I think all of that comes through in his understanding of a very ordinary heterosexual couple. And I love him for that. I love him for his generosity of emotion that he was able to project onto a heterosexual couple, what I imagine he lived almost his entire life dealing with.
Although I don't think he was all that closeted, do you?
But then there was still an awful lot of rules and regulations and laws.
Yeah.
That, however,
you go to jail. In
absolutely.
Fact,
and I don't.
That was all changed, I think, in the '60s.
Yeah.
The film prominently features Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 2, a way that I'm sure David Lean felt he could express the inner turmoil of these characters. You use it as well. And it's very effective in this. We have these Noel Coward songs, and then we have the great, powerful Rachmaninoff No. 2, done wonderfully with your character playing the piano, and then we see her face.
Yes.
As well. So you're using cinematic devices here.
Well, also, that's a quote, is that, you know, I didn't want to pretend that I'm not taking one of the most famous movies of all time, and what do you think of when you think of Brief Encounter? You think Trains and Rachmaninoff. You know, I wasn't going to deny the audience that. But I don't know if you noticed, but we also sing the version a couple of times before. So, again, I like to subvert it in the same way that there's trains, that the first train you see, the first train is invisible, the second train is a tiny toy train. So just build the fun of the language.
Is this the same cast, Annette, that was in the original UK production?
No, not an original cast member. I came in for the tour, the UK tour, and it's about half and half, I think, now.
You have been doing it for about
I've been doing
year.
It for, yeah. But I actually saw this in London when it was first done in previews, and it had such a huge effect on me. And I remember walking out thinking, God, I'd love to do something like that, and God, I'd love to work with Emma. And then, so I kind of feel like, you know, it's been amazing journey for me, because I'm now doing this show and I love it, and been doing it all over the place, and
all over the place, which
York.
Means you've been touring with it. You were in San Francisco before you
San
came
Francisco,
here,
yeah.
And we're on our way to Minneapolis, which I believe is going to be even colder than New York.
That's at the Guthrie.
Yeah.
Well, you will get a chance to find out how American audiences are different in different parts of the country.
Yes.
The audiences in Brooklyn tend to be very appreciative.
We've had a brilliant time. But San Francisco they loved it in San Francisco. But then it was summer as well. It's a very warm, open. We've had a fantastic time. I've found that the American audiences have really got the humour and really understood the pathos as well. So there's been no cultural divide at all that
and
I
quite
can see.
Interestingly, here as well, in New York, so many people have seen the film. In San Francisco, not many people had seen the film, but here, loads and loads of people
That's
have seen the film. So.
Well, we're much classier in New York than they are in San
Francisco. Obviously.
You didn't know that?
Emma, you
were nominated for the Olivier Award for Best Director?
Yes.
That must have been a thrill.
Well, it was a thrill. I didn't win, which was less of a
That's
thrill.
That's a less.
it was a thrill. And in fact, I didn't get to go to the awards ceremony because I managed to get very ill just before. So in my imagination, it was amazing.
Now, none of the members of this cast are well-known in this country, but I wondered why. Laura and Alex, Hannah Yelland and Tristan Stark are just amazing.
They are.
They're brilliant, aren't they?
They are.
And Laura does something physically. I don't know if I should give it away, but she does something physically that is just extraordinary at a moment of emotional...
High kicks.
Yes.
Are you thinking of the chandelier?
Yes.
Yes. I'm going to say the word chandelier, and then your listeners can put the rest together in their imaginations.
But the whole cast seems to work very well. This is a wonderful ensemble production.
It's a fabulous. And, you know, Annette just said she wasn't the original Myrtle, but in fact, the production's had two casts, and this what you've got in New York is a mix. So we have half original members and half new members. And in fact, what's happened is there's been a new chemistry, and the show continues to be so fresh. And for my money, these are the best actors and performers money could possibly buy.
The only sad part of this is that it closes on the 17th.
It does.
And
yes.
There's no chance of extending the run.
Not at the moment, no, because we're off to Minneapolis.
Mm. Well, come back. Brief Encounter is at St. Anne's Warehouse along the Brooklyn waterfront now through the 17th. You can find ticket information on our show page at WNYC.org. And my great thanks to Emma Rice, who put together the adaptation and directed, and Annette McLaughlin, who plays Myrtle. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
She's so good at love. Her heart is so wise and free. She'll get that golden goose, whoever it may be, with all her articulate tenderness.